Let's go.
Oh, no.
Do you
want to?
Sorry. I'll let you.
I'm excited and I feel relaxed and I'm ready to party.
Don't say sorry. You don't need to do that. You don't need to apologize. It's a fucked up female habit. You don't need to be sorry for anything ever.
Can you guess what every woman's worst nightmare is?
I don't have rage issues!
I have nothing to prove to you.
When I'm good, I'm very good. But when I'm bad, I'm better.
I say when it comes to stardom and Lauren, there are no accidents.
Hi, Karen Peterson.
Hello, and welcome to Citizen Dame, the podcast where today we're recording and it's 420, but that's just a coincidence. I'm Karen Peterson.
Don't you lie to the people.
Well, I mean, it's a coincidence that we're recording on 420.
Go on. There's a reason why we chose the films that we did, Karen. We discussed this.
I just thought we were just, you know, just picking movies we felt like talking about.
Just three movies, just three random movies.
Well, thank you for joining us, Lauren Humphreys Brooks.
Sorry, I interrupted your opening. Now I've thrown everything off.
Well, I mean, I think that's going to be the theme for today. We're just going to throw everything off.
So how are you? I'm good.
Good. We're already starting off great. We're off the rails. And I love it. So today is like I said, but when you're listening to this, it will be past. But today is 420 and we thought it'd be fun to talk about drug movies. Some very specific ones. And this is gonna be fun. Before we get there, I wanted to take a minute and talk about I got invited to kind of at the last minute to go to TCM Classic Film Festival, which is happening this weekend in Los Angeles. And it's a festival I've wanted to go to for a long time. And every year I miss the window to apply for press credentials. I just forget every single time. And this year I was asked if I could cover for Kristen Lopez asked if I could go. And so I've been going with her. And speaking of drug movies, last night I was at the Midnight Movie, which was a screening of a movie called The Road to Ruin from 1934. Co-directed by Dorothy Davenport. So, you know, like a movie that's right on the cusp of the Hays Code and directed by a woman. How could I say no to that? It is a movie. It's a remake of a silent film from 1928, but it's basically this girl and she's kind of new in town. She's just trying to get to know some of the local kids. And she befriends this girl named Eve, who is a bit of a party girl because her mom is a party girl too. And so it's all about like the dangers of how easy it is to just veer off course and just slide into ruin and destroy your life. And it's not a funny movie. There are definitely some things that are funny that I wonder if they were in 1934. It's very much like she meets a cute boy and then that doesn't work out. And she ends up with this like older man who turns out to be a terrible person. And they drink and they smoke and they skinny dip in a pool. There's actual nudity in this movie too. I was surprised by that. Yeah.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah. So anyway, it's quite a movie. Kino Lorber apparently has it. So if you have an opportunity to watch it, I suggest it.
Interesting. Kino has done a number of those like kind of the public service films basically where they've released them. So like, you know, and some of the most famous ones are like Reefer Madness, right?
But, right. And this is kind of in the same vein, but not the same tone as Reefer Madness.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, Kino has released a number of those. They're fascinating artifacts in a lot of ways. And it's kind of a good reminder of some of the attitudes of the previous generations and maybe, you know, consideration of our own as well. Some of the things that we're told about drugs and alcohol and smoking.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and there's a whole lot about just like blaming the parents for the behavior of the kids too, and it feels very much like it's a movie made for parents to, like, you know, watch out for what your kids are up to type of thing, and also for the kids too, like, you could die if you do this behavior.
there's a film from, like, I think it's actually from the late 40s, early 50s, called I Accuse My Parents. Mystery Science Theater did like a riff of it, right? And that's where I first saw it. The film itself is actually very well made, but it is one of those where it's like oh, the fall of the youths and all of this stuff. And I think that does involve like marijuana and a bunch of different things. And some of the lies that are told about what marijuana does to you, just like, that's not how that works, but okay.
Yeah. So besides that, is there anything you've been watching lately that you want to mention?
Nothing particularly new. I have been watching some of these Italian melodramas, and I can never pronounce the director's name. It's Raffaello Matarazzo. And so there's a collection of these films on Criterion Channel, actually. And I was going through my list the other day. I was like, oh, I put these on my list and I never actually like watch any of them. So I watched the first one the other night. It's really good. It's very much like, you know, the Italian films of this period. This is like 1940, late 1940s and into the 50s. So it's right at the point of Italian neorealism. And these are like the opposite of Italian neorealism. It's melodrama and, like, you know, affairs and you know, more and morality tales and all kinds of things. It's very well acted and very entertaining to watch. So the first one is called Chains, and it's about this like young woman who is happily married to this really nice guy, and they've got a couple of kids, and then into their lives comes her former lover, who's a criminal. And he's like, oh, I've been obsessed with you for years. And, you know, and it was this whole thing where they were sort of separated by the war. He went off to war and then he never came back, and she fell in love with this other guy and got married. And then it just kind of escalates in a way that you would expect it to in a melodrama. And it is a very entertaining film, and I want to watch more of them now, because most of the films like star these two major Italian stars in kind of the lover roles. And they're very charming together. And at the same time, I'm sitting there going like, I know where this is going. It's very like Douglas Sirk melodrama, but in Italian.
That sounds so fun.
Yes.
Cool. All right. Well, should we get into our topic of the day?
I think we should. We were talking about, you know, the dangers of drugs and alcohol.
Yes. And so there's obviously a lot of stoner comedies and drug movies to pull from, but we came up with three very specific ones that we thought could be fun to talk about all together in an episode. So we're going to start with, from 1998, two movies from 1998, The Big Lebowski and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And then we're going to wrap up with 22 Jump Street. So, yeah. So we'll talk about the drugs and then end with a drug bust. So, oh man. All right. So 1998, Big Lebowski premieres at the Sundance Film Festival in January. And then it is released in theaters, I think, in March. And this is the Coen brothers doing this like stoner comedy noir Chandler-esque movie. And it stars Jeff Bridges. Gosh, who else is in this movie? John Goodman, Julianne Moore, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Steve Buscemi, Tara Reid, John Turturro, Sam Elliott, just a lot of big names pop up in this movie, as they do in Fear and Loathing as well. But anyway, so basically, Jeff Bridges plays a guy, Jeff Lebowski, just known as the dude, and his house gets these guys show up at his house and start trashing the place because they are enforcers, and they have him mistaken for a rich guy named Jeffrey Lebowski. And when the dude decides after his rug gets ruined, he wants his rug replaced, he goes to Jeffrey Lebowski's house and ends up in the middle of a possible kidnapping and extortion plot, and then other chaos ensues.
That's one way to summarize this film. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, it's just one of those where it's like things get progressively more chaotic and weird.
Yeah.
But it all comes back around to kind of a point at the end. They definitely close the loop of what this movie is. This was my first time watching it, actually, which I know surprises a lot of people. I just had never gotten around to seeing it. And then it just became like, I knew eventually I would watch it, but it just became funny to tell people I'd never seen The Big Lebowski. So I just kind of kept not watching it until this week. So Lauren, you're the one that got me to watch The Big Lebowski.
So I think, Karen, what do you think of The Big Lebowski? Because I think that that's where we should start. Like, because this, it is an iconic stoner film, right? And I think that because it's iconic, it kind of gets short shrift as an actual film.
Yeah.
Because people are kind of like, oh, it's like the dude abides, you know, all of those things. And it's just like, okay, but if you actually watch the movie, there's a lot more going on than that.
That's the thing. It's like, so I assumed it was most, I mean, I kind of knew there was a little bit of a noir element to it, but I thought that was really minor to the movie. I thought it was mostly a stoner comedy because of everything that I've heard people talk about with it and all the clips that I've seen. And it wasn't until you said it was very much a film noir that was, how did you describe it? Now I can't even remember.
I think it's like a film noir where a 70s stoner is the detective. Like,
yes.
Or a 70s stoner shoved into a film noir. It's something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, okay, I haven't actually ever heard it described that way. And now I'm like, okay, now I have a totally different expectation of what this movie is going into it. So, I really enjoyed it. It was funny because a bunch of people, when I noted that I was finally watching it, I got several comments from people that were like, oh, that's a movie that is really rough the first time. You have to watch it multiple times to really enjoy it. I disagree. But I'm very much a Coen Brothers fan.
Yeah.
There are very few. I can't think of any off the top of my head Coen Brothers movies that I absolutely do not like. I'm sure there's something, but nothing's coming to mind right now. Anyway, so that helps. That definitely helps. But it's definitely a movie where things progressively, or regress, I don't know. Things get more and more chaotic throughout the movie, and everything escalates as time goes on. But I just thoroughly enjoyed the experience of watching this guy who is just kind of content with his life and just, you know, like nothing in his life is great, but he's just kind of whatever. He doesn't really care because he's stoned all the time. But he finds himself in this crazy world that's not part of his experience normally. And you really get these glimpses of he's actually a very intelligent person. He's not someone who just is a burnout and just an idiot. He actually he puts a lot of things together. He figures stuff out because he's really smart. And then he's surrounded by just such an interesting group of characters. His best friends, Walter and Donnie, are just these like, Donnie is funny. I love Donnie, Steve Buscemi. And then it's like John Goodman is just the best, but you got Walter who like, that's Goodman. He's this Vietnam vet who that's all he talks about is Vietnam. Everything is compared to Vietnam, and just the way that he embodies that and the way that that informs so much of what his character decides to do as things go along It's brilliant. It's really good. And so I think my big takeaway from The Big Lebowski is that it's such a much smarter movie than I expected it to be.
Well, yeah, exactly. I think that it has actually, because it's become such an iconic kind of cultural touch point, it has actually been ill-served by that, mm-hmm. because there is this attitude. And I think it's because like there are a lot of people who basically what they took away from it was, oh, it's like a stoner movie. And it's like, it's very much treated as kind of, not to knock Cheech and Chong, but it's very much treated like that, right?
Right.
Where the main point is that the guy's a stoner. The whole thing with the dude, right, is that he has made a number of very conscious choices mm-hmm. about his life and the life that he wants to live. And so part of it is actually this like push back against all of the things that the other Lebowski, the Big Lebowski, represents, right? And you know, he wants his rug back. Like, it really tied the room together. But you've got all of these jokes and everything that I think kind of people pay attention to that and not to what the film is actually doing. And so you miss, like, you know, I recently rewatched The Long Goodbye with Elliot Gould. And in watching The Big Lebowski, I was like, these films have more in common with each other than we give them credit for. It is because he is that sort of a detective where he's just like, I'm going to do this because it's necessary. And like, he's actually concerned. So like, this woman's been kidnapped, right? I got to help her, right? He is actually trying to help people. He is actually trying to do the right thing. He doesn't really want to be involved in all of this, but he's the Raymond Chandler detective. He's the good man, right?
Yeah.
And that just threads throughout the entire film. And we shouldn't ignore that simply for the fact that there is all this other comedy that goes on around him.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's interesting, it's like an interesting play on the noir detective, is that, you know, so many, we've talked about this a lot because we've talked about noir a lot, but so many of those detectives, they're these hard-boiled, like, they drink a lot, and drinking is a like alcohol is a depressive, and so they get really just like down and bitter is another big thing. Whereas the dude, because his choice is not alcohol, it's marijuana, he's a lot more relaxed and just like kind mm-hmm. of just goes with the flow, and everything is just a little bit lighter around him. The world is falling apart. There's a lot of really serious stuff happening, but because he's not depressing himself, he's able to just kind of go with it. You know, like his car gets destroyed right in front of him, and that sucks. And he's not happy about it, but he's just kind of like, well, all right. He's driving without a windshield. You know, it makes for a character who is definitely similar to those other types of detectives, but just so like it just a completely different attitude and a different like he just approaches mm-hmm. things differently. And so he's also compelling to watch in a completely different way for totally different reasons.
Yeah. And it's there's that altruism, I guess. And that's one of the things that I associate with, you know, with Raymond Chandler, particularly Philip Marlowe, is very often represented as being this guy he's put upon, right? Mm-hmm. He's constantly doing work for people that he doesn't actually like and everything, but that's what he does. He's a knight, right? He's kind of this knight errant. And there's this quote from Raymond Chandler that is, and I can't remember, I think it's from actually one of his essays about noir and detective stories, hard-boiled stories, is that it's something like, down these mean streets a man must walk who is not himself me. And that's kind of what the dude represents. Like, mm-hmm. it's very much like, and in fact, we even get that at the beginning of the film with, you know, Sam Elliott and his voiceover saying, like, you know, sometimes there's a man. Sometimes there's a man. I don't remember where I was going with that because I got distracted, but sometimes there's a man. And it is just like that, yeah, sometimes there's a man. it runs throughout the entire film. And it is very funny, but there's also this like undercurrent of, you know, and we get glimpses of the dude's background. as much as we do with like Walter, who is a Vietnam War vet and is definitely traumatized, for all his humor, he's also like not quite all there. But we also get some of the dude's background, like this, you know, he talks about he talks about being one of the original writers of the Port Huron Statement. He was occupying buildings in Seattle. Like he was a real countercultural activist, right? And then at some point it kind of got away from him. And you're talking about a film that's kind of set in post-Reagan America, and in this space where you know, they talk about Saddam Hussein, and in this space where, you know, people like the dude and like Walter are no longer treated as necessary. You've lost, right? That's one of the things that the Big Lebowski basically says to him, you lost. Right. And one of the nice things that happens in the Big Lebowski is just like, maybe they didn't lose. Maybe they lost in one way, but maybe not in another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, just seeing, like, when you really get to the, I don't want to spoil it for anybody who hasn't watched The Big Lebowski, do it. Just watch it. It's totally worth it. It's on Hulu. Just go watch it. But yeah, I like how there is kind of this, when you get to the end and you understand the whole story of what this plot actually was. I feel like it has a good payoff. And so much of, the dude going through this, and he comes up with his theories of what happened. And even from the beginning, he's not totally off. Like he's got very good insight of what's happening. And, but the final reveal, it's like, man, it really does kind of, it's not an Eat the Rich movie, but it definitely does make some points about wealthy people and that world, and how being not in that world is not a bad thing.
Yeah, it's just like continuing to survive and to exist on your own terms. I mean, if the film doesn't have a message per se, and I think it's always, you know, I think the Coen brothers are more complicated than that, but yeah. But it is this like, the whole, I mean, one of the last lines of the film is that famous one, the dude abides. And mm-hmm. it's this whole thing like, shit's going to happen, basically. And you have to continue to exist on your own terms. And so one of the parts of rebellion is literally not being a part of that entire world, right? That this craziness that is around him is not something that he actually wants to be engaged with. And he has to deal with it, but then he can also walk away and go bowling.
Right.
And that is in itself very important.
Yeah. I wanted to just take a minute to mention a couple of behind the scenes facts that I love. So the Coen brothers, obviously, I mean, we have talked about a few of their movies. We really like a lot of their stuff. And they tend to work with some of the same people again and again. So like Carter Burwell does the score for this. He did the score for a lot of their other films. Also just a three-time Oscar nominee. He did the music for Carol too. And then just recently with the Banshees of Inisherin. So, and then this is shot by Roger Deakins. He was the cinematographer on that, which I did not realize. And the great Roger Deakins. So I just wanted to mention some of that. So it's the Coens really do put together very smart and creative people behind the scenes too. Not just good performers on screen, which, you know, they have their kind of their troupe of people that you see in a lot of their movies, with John Goodman, Turturro, mm-hmm. and all of them. And it just, it all works. It everything about this movie just works together on a very, very good creative level.
It really does. Yeah. Like it actually, you know, when I saw that Roger Deakins photographed it, and then I began watching, just like, I can see that actually. Yeah. Like it's not one of those that you would expect that. Like you'd be like, oh, this is a Roger Deakins book. It's not broad, right? It's mm-hmm. not an epic in scale story, but it is gorgeously photographed. And like some of the choices that are made about how things are framed, like the entire sort of hallucinatory dream sequence with like the bowling and like all of that stuff is just very, it's just very well done and very funny, but like brilliantly shot.
Well, Deakins just has, he has a very specific way that he plays with light, and especially colorful, like neon light, that just works so well. And yeah, and you really do see that here. So.
I also one of the things I really like is that the all of the noir archetypes are there. And I feel like, and again, in rewatching this, I was just like, yeah, this is like The Big Sleep, only it's a bunch of weird stoners. It actually reminded me in a lot of ways of the book, not the film, Thomas Pynchon's Inherent Vice, which is significantly, it was written significantly later than this film, but it's similar in that sense where you're transposing the kind of noir detective story of something like The Big Sleep onto this apparently completely foreign space, right? So the space of like stoners and old hippies and Reaganomics and stuff like that. And then you're sort of flipping all of the characters and you're showing all of these different characters and how they interact. And that's one of the things I think the Coens are very good at. We talked about this with Blood Simple as well, that it's like you're taking these noir plots that the audience, if you've seen any noir, the audience is going to recognize, even if you don't know exactly what is happening, you're going to recognize it at some level. And then playing with those archetypes. And so like we've got the dizzy heiress, played by Juliana Moore. We've got like Ben Gazzara. They got Ben Gazzara to play like a pornographer, right? You've got the gang who's kind of off to the side of the nihilists,
The nihilists. Oh
who
my gosh,
include
so funny.
Flea. Flea is there. Flea is actually in two of the films that we're
Yes,
talking
when
about.
we planned this episode, I was not expecting either of those appearances. And yet they make total sense.
All of those things, and I think one of the things that works really well is that all of these people are very much talking like their archetypes, except for the dude. The dude is like, what? Like they're it's as though they are kind of in a different film than he is, and he sort of cuts through a lot of the bullshit. Like, the whole some of the conversations between him and the Juliana Moore character, what's her name? Maud. Some of the conversations between them is like, her sort of trying to get him to respond to her in a particular way, and he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, who are these people? I love the whole line where she's like, do you know that most men are very bothered by the word vagina? And like she keeps on saying it. And then later he says, do you mean like vagina? It's just very funny. It's there's this like there's that tendency to cut through that bullshit and to kind of see it for what it is, but also just be like, okay, whatever. Like, that's fine. I'm gonna leave now.
It's a good movie.
A good movie.
It's very good. I expected that I would find it entertaining. I did not expect to find it as intelligent as it is. Which is my that's my mistake. I underestimated the Coens for some reason.
Never underestimate the Coens,
You
even
shouldn't.
when like even when their films are like ridiculously popular with people, just always be like, no, it's probably even better than what people are saying.
Yep, people are missing the point a little bit. Not that people miss the point of movies ever. Any other thoughts about The Big Lebowski?
Is a good film. Everybody is in it. And honestly, I think that if you've seen it and what you took away from it was, oh, stoner comedy, watch it again. Just like go back and watch it and be like, actually, this has some pretty interesting shit going on.
And yeah, so every 90s actor that was not in The Big Lebowski was in the next movie, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And there might be one or two crossover people too. Yeah, so Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is directed by Terry Gilliam. It's an adaptation of Hunter S. Thompson's novel. And this is Johnny Depp and Benicio del Toro as Raoul Duke and Dr. Gonzo drug tripping through Vegas. And this is quite a movie. This is much more divisive, I think,
It
than The Big
is.
Lebowski. And I understand that division. But this premiered at the Cannes Film Festival in 1998, and then it went out to theaters. And it has definitely had, we were talking about this before we started recording, it's had a bit of a reappraisal in the last few years where people are starting to come around to some of the more brilliant aspects of this film. But it also is one that I feel like you really have to be in the mood for it to be able to really appreciate it. And I think that's putting it mildly. I know
Yeah,
you
maybe.
really like this movie a lot, so.
Yeah, you have to really be in the mood for it, which means you have to be a 19-year-old university student who's just like head over fucking heels for Hunter S. Thompson.
That would
And
help. Yes, that would help.
that, yes, that would very much help. Yeah, I love this movie. I love this movie. Yeah, I completely understand. It's incredibly divisive and it's all over the place. It's messy. Actually, if you have read the book, and you watch the film, just like, yes, this is a perfect visualization of Hunter S. Thompson's book. Like it is. It one of the issues with the film is that it does miss some of the more political undercurrents of Thompson's writing. And it's again one of those things that he kind of gets reduced to this, you know, the sort of drug counterculture writer, and that's it, right? It's like it's much more superficial. And I think the film kind of contributes to that attitude, but a lot of what's going on underneath is this whole idea about this search for and the death of the American dream at the end of the 1960s and into the beginning of the 70s. And that's what Thompson is writing about. And I think that that's what the film produces in a really interesting way, but it's easy to get distracted by just the sheer bombardment of the visuals. And so it's easier to see in the book than it is actually in the in the film itself. So it's a flawed movie, but I do absolutely love it.
Yeah. So it is, it's set in 1971. It's this journalist who gets an assignment to cover this motorcycle race in Vegas, and so they leave from Los Angeles. He goes with his lawyer. And they just spend the entire time just getting progressively more and more stoned, essentially. This is a movie that I've seen it before. I admire it more than enjoy it. I find it very, very frustrating, a lot of the time. And it is so, there's just so much, there's so much happening, to put it
Yes, there
mildly.
is.
It's hard to, it's there's some of it is just so hard to look at. It's like it's gross.
It is, yeah.
And so many of the visuals are fascinating, but also off-putting. So that's why I say you really have to kind of be in the mood for this. Otherwise, it's just not going to work out very well for you. But yeah, I think that the way that it captures that the experience of just being on this crazy bender, I've never had that experience, but watching it, I'm like, okay, I feel like I can understand what this feels like. If it's very visceral, it's very it really does, it does pull you in. And so much of that is because of Johnny Depp and Benicio del Toro's performances. They're so convincing in these increasingly chaotic roles. And I mean, Depp even has kind of this not really an accent, but sort of this affectation to his voice, and he walks in a certain way and everything, and it feels it's exaggerated, but it feels very like believable. It doesn't feel like an actor who's just doing these things, these mannerisms to play this character. It really feels like he's embodying this character, and so that's part of why it's definitely very watchable.
Yeah, it's the entire film is sort of an escalation, right? So you
Yeah.
start out with these two guys who are already high, zooming towards Las Vegas. They're already not on the same plane as everybody else. And then it just gets crazier and crazier. And it's one of those, in some ways, I almost liken it to like a party or something like that, where at a certain point, you're like, the party peaks and that's when everyone should leave. But if you don't leave, then shit gets really bad.
Yeah.
And that's what we begin seeing. So I think that one of the things that the film does really well is it gets at that, that the fun that then leans to something worse and that gets more and more dangerous and more disturbing. And that's particularly, I think, embodied in the Dr. Gonzo, the part played by Benicio del Toro. And he's right on the edge, right from the very beginning. But there's a certain point where he goes over the edge and you actually begin seeing like this goes beyond danger, right?
Yeah.
And it never pushes it so far as to truly tip over into, you know, extreme violence or anything like that, which it definitely could have. But that threat and the existence of that threat gets more and more prevalent as the story goes on. And I think that part of what is being depicted in the film again, and part of what is being depicted in the book, is this loss, essentially, that the death of the 60s, the death of this culture. There's a famous speech that is repeated in the film, and that comes directly from the book. It's the high watermark speech, where it's basically Duke reflecting on being in, specifically in San Francisco, but being in the 1960s, being in this the summer of love, experiencing this whole thing where you just thought that you were going to prevail. And that it was just going to be this entire movement of energy that would eventually win out over stupidity and violence and war and death. And then it failed. And so there's this whole thing about, you know, you could still see the high water mark where the wave crested, where the wave broke and receded. And that's kind of the undercurrent, I think, of the entire film, is that this is the receding wave. This is two people who have gone through that crest and then have come out the other side, and they don't really know what to do beyond that. And Duke in particular, who is Hunter S. Thompson, is talking about that death, that loss of the promise. And he refers to it as the American dream, but it's really the American dream of the 1960s, basically, like what could have been. And how it ultimately failed. And now you're in this space where, you know, he's still kind of, he's running a savage burn on these Las Vegas hotels, you know, sitting in the DA convention on acid and being like, this is a bad idea. It is a bad idea to be on acid here. But is actually watching this as being like, these are the people who won. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that is part of what is going on and is running throughout the film.
Yes, everything you just said was very smart and wise. I wanted to touch on that convention really quickly, because there's a lot of irony throughout the movie. And I think that it's really highlighted there, because this DA convention. So they finish the motorcycle race and then they're going to leave town because they've trashed their hotel room. But then he gets an assignment to go back for this convention, and it's on narcotics, and they're on acid. They're sitting in this ballroom and the presenter is talking about the dangers of marijuana, and they're like 500 steps past that.
there's a great line, I think this Dr. Gonzo says, like, you gotta be high on acid to think that a marijuana butt looks like a goddamn cockroach. It's great. Yeah, it's hilarious. And it is this, like, that one of the things I like about the film is that there is this very clear contempt for the straight world.
Yeah.
And I like that, because it's not necessarily saying that the drug world is better, but it's definitely more honest. And it is. And part of what Thompson does in his writing, what the film does really well, is filter all of that through this experience of drugs and through this experience of these two people who are like, this is bullshit, right? The straight world is weird and off-putting, and why these people are bizarre and crazy, and this is terrifying, right? And it does that really, really well. Like, this is bullshit, and we really need to open that up and expose the fact that it's bullshit.
Yeah.
And what are you going to do after that? You know, you can't really do anything because you can't defeat the district attorneys of America, right?
Right. But it also manages to do that without glamorizing the drug world either, because their experiences and just how chaotic everything is, how messy and just scary and dangerous it is, and how off, like, everything is just a little bit off kilter and then a lot off kilter. It never, it, at least for me watching it, I never at any point go, that looks fun, I want to do it. Which I think is a really, it's a very difficult balance to achieve, where you're trying to call out, like you say, call out the straight, normal, like, the non-drug world, while also not making drugs look like something that we all want to rush out and do. These particular drugs, like ether, like what all are
they
doing?
Everything.
He goes through an entire inventory of what they have, and it's just like, holy shit, you are not going to survive.
Like, I think on screen they do like amyls, ether. I don't think they ever actually smoke pot, to be totally honest. I think it's everything beyond that. Cocaine, acid, mescaline. There are a few things, like the adrenochrome thing, which is just a lie. That's not a real drug. But it's supposed to be like this amalgam of drugs, basically. They drink a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's the other thing. There's always alcohol mixed in there. Those are the ones that I can think of. But yeah, he's got an entire list, actually, of like, this is everything that they brought with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just... It's...
And they're mixing them, too. It's right. Not like... It isn't like they're doing one drug and then it waiting for it to lose power and then do something else. Just like, no, we're just going to keep on doing all kinds of things.
Yeah.
At the same time.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, it's very much like, you are not going to survive. And there are a few times where they almost don't, which, yeah, that's a whole other thing. But just a quick rundown of some of the people that show up in this movie. So you've got Tobey Maguire as this hitchhiker that they run into more than once. Well, Raoul does anyway. Who else is in this? Mark Harmon. Gary Busey, I think.
Yeah, Gary Busey.
Cameron Diaz.
Mm-hmm.
We already mentioned Flea. Debbie Reynolds contributes some voice work there. Ben mm-hmm. Gillette, like a bunch of Vegas type folks also pop in. And then Christina Ricci, very young Christina Ricci.
Ellen Barkin is there at the end. She's
and
the
some
waitress.
Of these, it's like, I didn't know any of these folks were in it, and then they show up and it's like, wait a second, that's, you know, whoever. And there's a lot of that throughout.
Hunter S. Thompson himself appears very briefly as himself.
Oh yeah.
in fact, Johnny Depp as Raoul Duke sees himself, Hunter S. Thompson, sitting at a table at a club, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just to note, the performance that Depp gives is, if you ever watch any footage, or Thompson even did a commentary on the DVD of Fear and Loathing, that is Hunter S. Thompson. Like, he gets him perfectly. That is how he acts. That is how he moves. That is how he talks. So, yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit specifically about Johnny Depp and
yes,
how he used to be so great. He is one that just makes me so sad.
Go on.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think that both, I'd also like to talk about Del Toro in a minute, but Depp he's so good. He's so compelling to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, he isn't Johnny Depp in this film. He is playing this character. Like I said, he is very much he gets Thompson's mannerisms, et cetera. But even if you don't know that, he is Raoul Duke. You see him embodying that. You barely recognize the fact that he's Johnny Depp. And yeah, it's very sad. Like this is one of my favorite films. I just absolutely adore this movie. And I haven't watched it in ages, like literally until just recently for this, because I am so sad about Johnny Depp.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So it's like he just he it's not just Fear and Loathing. He used to just really embody every character. I mean, that's ultimately why he ended up getting an Oscar nomination for Pirates of the Caribbean, which is a movie that nobody thought would get, Oscar nominations for an acting performance, he always was somebody who really disappeared into every role. He made them all different. And then he just at some point just kind of crossed over into kind of becoming Hunter S. Thompson, becoming Marlon Brando, or at least trying so hard to, and it really ruined him. It's just, it's so sad.
It's really sad. And one of the things, I'd have to say about Hunter S. Thompson, and I don't idolize the guy. I love his writing. He's a fantastic author. He's very insightful. And you do have to look past, like, you're just like, oh, the drug guy. It's like, no, that's not what this is about. But one of the things that he openly said numerous times was, don't be like me. Like, he's literally like, don't do these things. That's stupid. What I did was stupid. What I do is stupid. It's dangerous. And I think that someone like Depp missed the memo on that. Like, didn't really wanted to be some of these guys, particularly people like Thompson and Brando, but you don't really want to be those guys.
Yeah. Depp
And
is someone who would watch Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and say, that looks fun. I want to do it.
yeah, exactly. You're kind of like, no, you don't, dude.
No.
Look at what
Yeah.
happens.
Yeah. It's just so sad.
Can we mention Benicio del Toro really quickly,
Yes.
though? Because one of the things that also was remarkable in this film is that this is 1998, and so they took two of the biggest heartthrobs of the late 90s and made them into those guys.
Right.
Like del Toro in particular is just fucking terrifying. He is compelling as hell and he's fascinating, but he is also terrifying, and he is terrifying from the moment he comes on screen, and he only gets crazier. And you get that, those moments of like, you really like this guy, and then you have this blast of, but he is dangerous.
Yeah. You feel like
And
one of them is going to die and it's going to be his fault.
yeah, so something is gonna like snap and he's gonna kill someone, right? It's always right there under the surface, and then it gets closer and closer to the surface. And he manages to do that so well, where he keeps that character very compelling and even in places really likable. Like, I like listening to him. I want to see him on screen. And then, having those like punctuations of like, and now the kind of the change happens, right? It's this almost Jekyll and Hyde element to it. This the final one of the final major scenes with him in the diner, where you're just like, is he gonna kill someone? Is he gonna kill this woman? Like, it's so frightening, and nothing actually happens, but it's so frightening at the same time. And that's difficult to do. And yeah, I mean, the whole thing, with his story, the whole thing closes with, he's too weird to live and too rare to die. It's the sensation of like, this is someone who shouldn't exist anymore, basically, but he does.
Yeah, and he's just gonna keep doing what he's doing, and he's gonna keep, like he has this way where he just like kind of keeps getting away with stuff, and just to the idea that there's someone out there in the world like that, yeah, it's terrifying. And Del Toro really does such a great job of being that guy. Any other final thoughts?
No, it is, if you've not seen Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, I recommend seeing it. Like Karen says, it is definitely a divisive movie. It is definitely a movie you got to be in the mood for. But it is amazing. And also, if you've not read the book, check out the book sometime, because Thompson really is writing an elegy for the 60s, in 1971. And that's a lot of what is going on in the story. And I think that the book gets at that in a way that the film doesn't completely, because the film's being made in 1998. The book was written in 1971. And so you don't get that same kind of immediacy of what was happening. But Thompson really, like, he should be read, I think, beyond this, the kind of drug culture element, and the film should definitely be watched.
Yeah, it's not currently streaming for free anywhere, but I rented it just on, I guess it's Fandango at home now. It's not Vudu anymore. So yeah, you can definitely find it, or you can just go to Lauren's house because she has it.
And the Blu-ray, I think 4K or Blu-ray is coming out on Criterion again in a month or so. So
Yeah, I
there's
actually
part
think
of
it's
that.
this month.
Ooh, if it's this month, I'm
I
gonna
think it's
get
very soon. Yeah. So there you go. All right. Well, we're going to switch over now to our final movies. So now that we've talked about stoners and druggies, let's
it.
talk about the cops that
We've
catch
represented the drug culture. Now we got to represent the cops, I guess. These are not good cops, I will say.
They're pretty terrible cops, and they even know it too. So they're the let's see, Phil Lord and Christopher Miller. They in what year was it? They did 21 Jump Street in 2012. And when that movie came out, it was with Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum. When I first heard they were doing a comedy version of 21 Jump Street, I was very annoyed because speaking of Johnny Depp, 21 Jump Street was my introduction to him, and that is not a funny show. It's a great show. There's so much good about it. I think it's available on Peacock or Hulu or something. You can watch like the whole show. It was definitely not, it was not funny. And so when I heard that they were doing a comedy with Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum, I was just like, oh, that's going to be terrible. But then it turned out it was not terrible because Phil Lord and Christopher Miller are two filmmakers who actually know how to do nostalgia right, I think, in a lot of ways. They did this with the Lego Movie. They've done it with some other things too, where they kind of know where the line is between being too precious with the things that you love and having fun with it and being able to reminisce in a good way. And I think the Jump Street movies are a good example of that. And so 21 Jump Street comes out. It actually ends up being really funny and very popular and successful to the point where they do a sequel, 22 Jump Street in 2014. One of the things that I personally enjoy about 22 Jump Street is how meta it is about the fact that it's a sequel, and sequels are never as good as the original, and they're just a cash grab, and it's all just about, trying to rehash the same material. But I actually personally think 22 Jump Street is a better and funnier movie than the original. So, but this was your first time watching it, I believe.
Just do it again. Just do the same thing again. We even have a bigger budget this time. Look at this. Look at why do we spend money on this office? This is weird. We moved across the street for some reason. I don't know.
What do you think of 22 Jump Street?
I mean, I had not avoided watching this one. I enjoyed 21 Jump Street. I remember this movie came out. I was like, eh, whatever, right? And yeah, and this loads of fun. I mean, it is. It's I do really like all of the meta elements. I like the fact that, they're not being like, oh no, this is a brand new story. It's just like, no, you're just gonna do the same thing again, but in college, right? Just like you guys are going to college, you're going to military school, you're going to dance academy. Like, it's very smart about it, and I think that self-awareness, which the first film also had, it had a lot of self-awareness. It very much like carries through, and the fact is, they really hang a lot on Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill, and at this point in their careers, they do a great job with it.
Yeah.
They're very funny. They have good chemistry together. They're believable as friends, actually. And then also like believable in kind of these ridiculous roles that they've been cast in. And it's never self-serious, but takes it just seriously enough to like be certain we know the stakes and we're interested and excited and we enjoy what we're watching.
I love Jillian Bell in this. She plays a character named Mercedes, who is the roommate of a girl that Jonah Hill's character falls for. And I love how she's just constantly, you're like 40. Like, why are you here?
All of the age jokes. She just like rattles them off in like this deadpan expression. So it's fantastic. She's so funny.
Yeah, she's really funny. She deserves a bigger career than she's had. So, but I feel like this was kind of one where a wider audience actually got to meet her, and it kind of was a boost for her career too. So
yeah.
One scene that actually kind of put this movie back in my brain, and I was like, oh, we need to talk about this. So there was something going on. There's something going around on Twitter a week or two ago that was share a clip from a movie where a character, like the best reaction where a character realizes something. And the person that I saw posted a clip from 22 Jump Street that is honestly so hilarious. And so basically Jonah Hill's Schmidt meets this girl in one of his classes named Maya, and they hook up, and he's going, and he's talking to Channing Tatum about it. And Ice Cube plays their captain. And he's telling them about this, and the captain is just like, yeah, man, get it. Well, then later come to realize that Maya is the captain's daughter. And the scene where Channing Tatum puts this together and realizes that, oh my gosh, Schmidt just slept with the captain's daughter and was bragging about it to his face is so funny. He starts dancing around the station. He's laughing. He's just having a good old time. And then he makes the point about how the captain was totally in on this until he found out it was his little girl. And it's like, sure, you go get it with a college kid, except for not my college kid. It's just it's like, it's not subtle, but it's just kind of this like kind of tucked in there, and it's so brilliant and so funny.
I you know, honestly, throughout this film, Channing Tatum is the MVP. Like, he is so funny. And that combination of like self-effacement of like, you know, oh, he's this big, good looking, muscular guy, he's like good at everything. And at the same time is just so hilarious and sensitive and is like really invested in his human sexuality class. And there are so many, there are a lot of gay jokes in this movie, but I like a lot of the time, not all of them, but a lot of the time they handle them really well. And like this buildup of like, at some point are these guys going to realize that they're like in a romantic relationship with each other, basically? they talk about it as though it's a romantic relationship. There's this whole thing about, oh, my partner, right? But then he blows their cover at one point by yelling at the guy for calling them a name, a homophobic slur. And he's just like, you can't say that. Mm-hmm. Like, that is a homophobic statement. He like goes off on it. It's hilarious.
Oh my gosh. He's so funny. He just needs to just do comedy. He's so good.
He's so good, and he's so good at it. Like, it is just like similar to Chris Hemsworth in a lot of ways, very much playing off of those, you know, that the fantastically good looking guy who's actually just a sweetheart who like wants to be loved and is like the nicest dude and is also just very funny.
And also not afraid, like, he doesn't take himself too seriously. He's not afraid to look silly for the audience. And that's part of why it just works so well. I mean, even just in the very beginning when they're I love how they were told they're getting sent to college, and then it turns out it's online college and they're having to listen to online lectures for clues. But then they're trying to bring down this they're trying to stop a drug deal, and they go in pretending to be Hispanic drug guys, and they have these funny accents. Well, Janko, Channing Tatum, can't do a Spanish accent, so he's like Swedish or something.
I don't know what he's trying to do, but it is not working. I mean, not that Schmidt is particularly good right. at it either.
He's but... very much doing the trope, which yeah. is also very bad, but yeah. My name is Jeff.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is one of the elements with Tatum is that he isn't afraid to be silly and goofy and to make himself look like an idiot. Like, mm-hmm. and that in itself is very entertaining.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, he really understands that is something that's going to be satisfying for the audience. So
yeah,
it's good. And I mean, the story here is kind of incidental. So like they are bringing down a drug cartel or whatever and a drug lord, but really the experience of the movie is not so much about that. It's about this relationship between these two who have been through so much together, and their relationship kind of goes through this metamorphosis. They kind of hit this point where they want to go their separate ways. They have a big fight, you know, all couples fight, and they kind of have to find their way back to each other, but also while being true to themselves and looking at what they want out of life too. So there's this like mm-hmm. strangely, again, kind of like what we were talking about before with Big Lebowski, definitely not to the same level, but there is this like intelligence to it too, and where it's not just what you like, it's not exactly just as straightforward as you think you're gonna get in just, oh, it's this comedy about these bumbling cops. There's mm-hmm. a lot more to it than that that actually makes it a fun experience.
Yeah, and like you say, it's very smart, it's very meta. It and one of the things I like about the use of the meta is that it doesn't go overboard on it.
Right.
It's not like, oh haha, we're doing a sequel and that's the joke. Like that's not the main joke of the story. It's right. referenced and it's very clear, especially at the beginning of the film. But that's not the thing that they just keep on hammering at. Mm-hmm. And because of that, it doesn't feel like one of those sort of nostalgia cash-ins itself being like, oh, we know what we're doing. It's like, no, you know what you're doing, but also you're doing something else.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it fun. You're kind of trading off of the fun of watching these guys.
Yeah. Any other final thoughts?
It's a lot of fun. Like I really did enjoy watching it. I'm not surprised by that or anything like that. You know, fuck the police, obviously. but these guys are not very good police. So.
I do get a kick out of watching Ice Cube play a cop.
It's yeah, it's a it's a weird thing to reconcile. You're just like, dude, I don't know if this is like selling out or like actually really cool and subversive in its own weird ass way. Like, I don't know, man.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it is intentionally subversive. So, I mean, I think that there was a very specific reason why they cast him in the first movie. So, yeah, and he was just so definitely. Good. You had to keep him for the second.
I really like he's got one line. It's just like, I'm wearing $700 shoes. You can't even see them. Just like, why did we spend money on this? I don't know, but we don't have any more money. So finish the job, but don't spend any money. then there's the whole thing just like, oh my god, we just spent so much, we just broke so much expensive stuff, don't turn into the robot lab, no.
I want to drive the Lambo. Oh, it's so good.
It's very funny.
Yeah. All right, well, this week was fun. I hope it was as fun for all of you listening as it was for us. Oh, maybe we're just talking into the void this week. I don't know. We'll find
good
out.
Good movies.
Yes, good movies. And you don't have to be stoned to enjoy them.
In fact, a couple of these I wouldn't recommend it. Although, I gotta say, I think Fear Nothing in Las Vegas while stoned would be very interesting. Don't know what would happen, but it'd be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. Not going to try it. Anyway. All right. Well, I think that's going to wrap things up for this week. So thank you all so much for listening. We would especially like to thank our patrons who help keep the show going. They are Abby, Ollie, Brian, Connor, Estefania, Heather, James, Judy, Carriata, Matt, Michelle, Monty, Nanita, Robert, Steve, Sharon, and Tao. I actually just want to take a second to thank our patron, Abby, who has been sending us comments pretty much every week for the last few weeks. And we read every one of them, and we really, really appreciate your thoughts. And this week had a lot to say about our Penny Marshall episode, and it was very nice to hear from you. So thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you'd like to join and become a patron yourself and help support the show and keep feminist film criticism alive and well in the world, you can go to patreon.com/citizendame and sign up. You can also support us by going to our Etsy store, etsy.com/shop/citizendamepod, or Ko-Fi, ko-fi.com/citizendame. And there's other ways you can find us too. We do have our email, which is citizendamepod@gmail.com. You can send us your thoughts, questions, comments, only nice things though. And we do have our website, citizendamepod.com. And we've got some newer reviews, some more stuff coming your way there. And yeah. And you can also find us on the social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at citizendamepod. Instagram or Twitter, not as much, but still kind of a little. And Blue Sky, also Citizen Dame Pod. And we are a Letterboxd HQ at Citizen Dame. And you can find us individually. Lauren, where are you?
I am primarily on Instagram and Letterboxd at LH Business.
And I am at Karen M. Peterson. So that's going to wrap things up for this week. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch you next time.
Bye.
Captain, we have something really, really important to tell you about. Captain, are you wearing Kevlar?
Now, gentlemen, we're not gonna sit here and pretend it's not a big-ass elephant in the room.
What the fuck is going on?
This is what the fuck is going on. Oh shit! Oh shit! Oh shit! No! That is not happening right now! No! Hey, yo, he's fucking the captain's daughter! Yo!
Every time you say that shit, my fuck. That's another foot in your ass.
Schmidt, you literally, yo, this is the best thing ever! Schmidt fucked the captain's daughter! Schmidt fucked the captain's daughter! Fuck! You fucked Captain Jason's daughter? Captain, what the fuck? You bragged to him to his face! To his actual face, Captain! Do you understand that this face right here, you bragged to that face? You actually high-fived Schmidt for fucking your daughter.